How much is that expat on the podcast? The one with the big glass of gin. How much is that expat on the podcast? I do hope you will listen in.
How are you, Stan?
Good, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
Episode 6, you feeling good?
I feel good.
The colour's back.
I know, the colour's back.
The hair is still in place.
They say next 2 days. Oh. It's always getting a bit boring, do you know? Like everyone's
are you
like
waiting for it
I
to
am.
Happen?
I am totally waiting for my hair to fall out and it's all still there. I do think it's getting thinner, but there's no evidence.
For anyone that's never seen Kirsty, she has thick
It's like
hair.
Carpet right yeah. down the back, isn't it?
Like you've got a lot of hair.
I do have a lot of hair. But, you know, the kids keep coming and giving it a yank and sort of saying, is it going to come out? You know, because we're all waiting for
waiting
it.
For it to happen.
We've got the wig, we've got the scarves, we're all ready.
Ready to go.
And the hair's still there. But they say, well, my GP had breast cancer last year and she said it really was. Someone said it happens between day 10 and day 14 and she right. said on day 12 she woke up and it was just on the pillow.
Gone. Right, okay.
Like it really is like that.
Right.
And our lovely friend Jenny from Styling Curvy, yes. she sort of said, because I said to her, oh, it's quite itchy. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, it gets a feeling of sunburn.
Ah,
and then it just goes.
Right. And yeah. see, her hair's grown back fabulously.
Oh, yeah.
She's got great hair.
She's got good hair. She's lovely. The old Styling Curvy. We've talked about her before, haven't we?
Yeah, she was one of our social media picks.
Yes.
Yes.
She was. Okay, so it says this week is just, it's been an amazing week for me interview-wise on mm-hmm. this subject. We talked about this last, well, I don't know, when did we start sort of getting our interview idea or our
I think
idea?
Just before we started season 2, we both sort of went away and thought, right, let's come up with some episode ideas. And this was something that I wanted to talk about because selfishly I want to learn more about it. So I thought, well, why not talk about it? So
we thought expat adoption.
Yes.
And I think the thing with doing this podcast is when I say to people, oh, we do an expat podcast, we talk about expat things, and they say, oh, like what? And then I immediately can't think of what it is that we talk about.
Even though we're like 1,000 episodes in, not that much, but we found a lot of stuff to talk about.
And so I'll say something like expat sex, and you can see people are going, well, how is that different? Mm-hmm. Why, you know, how do expats have sex any differently than anyone else? But the thing is, just about any topic, if mm-hmm. you put expat in front of it, it does change.
Yes.
And everything changes. And adoption, for me, I had not realised it is such a big difference culturally how we adopt children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what my biggest takeaway from this has been that in my Western upbringing, I have a very Western idea of mm-hmm. adoption, and it's not correct for international adoption.
Right.
And I think it's very easy in my little Australian world to be very judgy about mm-hmm. international adoption.
Right. Yeah.
And I've learnt from talking to a lot of women that you cannot put those two things in the same basket. You cannot talk about adopting a child in Australia in the same way that you're adopting a child in Asia mm-hmm. from a poverty-stricken family.
Right.
Do you know, they're
so different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And culturally, take away the money, just culturally how people feel about little girls as to how they feel about little boys.
Yes.
And just what life looks like for people and how that it's perceived to give up a child.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, in Australia we kind of believe that if you've got social security and that you have money, that if you just throw money at the problem it's okay.
Yes.
But quite often it's got nothing to do with money.
So
it says it was a bit personal for you.
As we've spoken about before on the podcast, I've had problems having children. We've got one gorgeous little girl, Sadie, who we had naturally, and we've been through the ups and downs of IUI and IVF, and I've lost 4 babies, and mm-hmm. to me they are babies. I lost 4 babies, and it then got to the point where Matt and I really had to make a decision: do we want to continue growing our family? If we do, which route do we want to take? Is it surrogacy or is it adoption? And then that brings up the questions of, you know, Sadie's nearly 8 now. It's been a long time since we've had to deal with nappies and formula and babies and for us at the moment, and I know this is going to come across as very selfish, but life is really easy for us right now. Yeah. Very easy. Mm. That's the three of us. It's very easy to pack up and go wherever we want to go. Mm. She's an easy kid. Life is good. But every night when I go to sleep, I still feel like there's just that something missing that I could.
Yeah.
I need to be a mum. And I am a mum, but I need to be a mum to more.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And that's the thing. That's a very, I think every mother recognises that feeling, mm-hmm. or everyone that wants to be a mother recognises that feeling, is either you desperately want to be, or maybe you've had two or three children, but there's something that just says, I'm not done.
And you had that after you had three children, didn't you? And still had that feeling the family was not finished.
Definitely. And I think the confusing thing is your feelings can float and change and wane. I mean, I am definitely, and I've learned this about myself, someone that would have just kept having babies. Do you know, I would have just kept going and kept going and kept going.
But you didn't grow up feeling like that, did
never,
you?
Never, never.
Whereas, see, I grew up thinking I was going to have baby after baby after baby after, and I didn't.
No.
Yeah,
no.
And I wonder what kind of mum I would have been.
Yes.
Had I had more children.
Yes, yeah. No, for me it was very, I was never having children, never mm-hmm. getting married. And
boy, did that change.
And, it changed. Like, obviously, the minute we fell pregnant with my eldest, then it was like, well, I knew immediately mm-hmm. I wanted to have another one. And I was one of those people that had her and I think probably minutes after thought, okay, let's get planning the next one, you know, because I loved it. I love the excitement of babies. I love that feeling. I love what it does to G and I. Do you know, I just, I love having a big family. But after number three, that was a bit of a physical challenge with, you know, I think he'd lived in five different countries in the top by the time he was sort of 6 months old. We dragged him all over the place and it was hard. And I think Greg and I were very much, no, well, maybe three kids in 5 years is enough.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I had that moment. He was about 14 months old, 14, 15 months old. I took a photo of him with the girls. They'd put him in a little tutu and they were all down in the playroom. Yeah. And I just took the photo and thought, there's someone missing in this picture.
Yeah.
And it really was a daily conversation from that moment of, I feel like there's someone missing. I feel like we need to do this. Now, when I was pregnant with number four, gee, when it had a vasectomy, I hope that's not too much information of his that I have just given the world. But I think he probably did it thinking, this woman's never going to stop, and she's in a frame of mind at the moment where she hates me because she's pregnant and she's done.
Yeah.
And I do think I probably would have 3 years down the track suddenly gone,
do you think you would have gone for number five, maybe?
I think I might have.
Wow.
I think I know people here in Doha that are like that too. Mm-hmm. I see it in other people where I go, oh, I don't think you got accidentally pregnant then.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think there is something, if you can have babies mm-hmm. reasonably easily, I think there's a fear of, well, when do you call it quits? Mm-hmm. Because I just really love having little babies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think now I've passed on and now I'm up to, okay, Lizzie's 15, when would she start having babies? Yeah. Do you know, like, when would I get my next baby?
Sadie's seven. Like, and I already talked to her about the grandchildren she's going to give me.
All right.
So we're going completely off track.
But, okay, I thought maybe we'll start with Melissa, who's in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And Melissa is an Australian listener who has been with us for a long time. And I'd said to her when I went to interview her, God, I almost feel like I know you because of that interaction online for a long time. But what I'll do is just get her to start by telling us about what her expat life has looked like and then why they started to consider adoption.
Okay.
Well, we started our expat life just a couple of years after we got married. We moved to Seattle and then we came back to Melbourne and had two babies, then moved to France to live for 4 years. And then we're lucky enough to be expatriated back to Sydney and had a little girl and then moved to Singapore. And we decided that when we had a 15-year-old, a 13-year-old and a 7-year-old, we decided that we would like another child. And we decided that we had had children easily enough and we could easily have another child, but it just, for us, we decided to look at adoption knowing there are lots of children in our region that need forever families, and that we're in a position that we could provide a stable home.
When you made the decision to adopt, how did that discussion go as a family? Because your bigger kids were big enough to really understand the process, I guess. So what sort of discussions did you have as a family talking about it?
Well, we sat the kids down, and the two older boys, I think, were just grateful that they didn't have the idea that we're actually having sex to make a baby. So they were very excited about the adoption route. They all were very excited, but I don't think they had any idea what bringing a baby into the family would be like as far as disruption goes. But they were just so excited, and she is actually the most adored child in our family. She's, their enthusiasm has never waned.
Wow. And had you seen people around you adopting, or was it something that came to you on your own?
No, it was something that came to us from our own. After we'd had the two boys, we did talk about adoption as a couple and decided that being Australian, it would be too difficult. We're back living in Australia at that time, and we thought it would just be too difficult, and we went on to have another little girl, and then we decided that this time it was right, and we thought that we could facilitate the adoption, being expatriated, we could facilitate the adoption easier than we could have done in Australia. Having birth children would have discounted us as adoptive parents in Australia.
Is that the case, is it, Melissa? Do you think that you wouldn't have been eligible for adoption?
No, not having three natural children, we wouldn't have been even put on the list. And we're both over the age of 35. And the adoption wait, I think, at the time that we're looking, was 7 years in Australia. So it meant we'd be over 40 and we wouldn't have been able to adopt.
So what did the process look like in Singapore to adopt? What did you have to do?
Well, here you go through an adoptive agent. So the first port of call is the a consulate of your home country to find out what the rules are. And then an adoptive agent, a home study by a local home study group, which ours was there's private groups, but ours was a government home study organisation. A compulsory lecture to make sure that you're of the understanding that you have to tell you that your child is adopted, because there are lots of parents who adopt of the same race and their child is never told they're adopted, apparently, in Asia. Our child is of a different skin colour to ours, so we actually thought that was quite incredible. We wondered at what stage that she'd actually turn around and ask, which she actually never has done. But, so from start to finish, it took 2 years because there was a change in government in Australia between me, Howard, and the Rudd government. And in that time, we're in the middle of our adoption, and nobody at the Australian High Commission in Singapore wanted to sign off on the adoption because they were concerned that Rudd would have different ideas about and change the adoption laws. So it took 2 years, and in the end we had to trace the the natural birth parents and make a transcript of a tape, or the High Commission in Kuala Lumpur medical transcript of the tape, saying that their child was given up voluntarily because the Australian High Commission here in Singapore was very concerned that the Australian government was going to tighten adoption laws. We adopted her through the Singapore court system, and the Singapore court system only took 6 months. So legally, she went, her parents left her at the hospital. They were never going to take her home. They were 18 and 20 when they had her, and well, the mother was 18, both mother was 18 when they had her, and they already had two other children. I think her first baby was born when she was 14. The two boys were, the grandparents would take them, but because my little girl was a girl, the grandparents wouldn't take her. So they left her at the hospital. She went straight from the hospital into a foster home, and we visited her there at 4 weeks of age. And then at 7 weeks, we had the legal papers to allow us to bring her into our home, which we did at 7 weeks.
How have you found people to react to the fact that you've chosen to adopt a child?
Look, it's about 50-50, positive, negative. A lot of people say, oh, that's amazing, it's wonderful. We don't ever think of it like that, because we think she's just added so much to our family, and we are just so grateful that we've been given this opportunity. But there's so many negative people. I was at a swimming lesson one day, and I was standing watching over the pool fence. My daughters swim in the pool, and a British lady came up to me and she said, oh, your daughter's adopted. And I said, yes, she's adopted, which is, you know, it's quite obvious. And she said, oh, I could never do it. I was at a dinner party last night, and we're all discussing that we could never, ever bring up a child that wasn't of our own blood. I said, you do realise that my daughter is just in the pool. You're actually talking about her. She said, oh, yes, but, you know, it's all right. She won't hear us. And afterwards, you think of all these comments you can say, but at the time you're thinking, really? You're really saying that?
How does, for your daughter, I mean, how does it look for her as an expat kid? Like, is there any difference? Is there anything that you think her world is different in any way, being an adopted child in an expat world, or is it it's a non-event?
I think it's a non-event. In her school at the moment, in her class, there's 3 adopted children, and we have an adoptive sort of group that we meet up once a month. And so there's lots of children adopted from all over the world, from Ethiopia, from Mexico. There's lots of children. So it's very positive for her. And being in an international school system, she's mixing with different nationalities all the time. But what is scary is the thought of taking her back to Australia. Because she does have dark skin, she's of Indian Tamil descent, and it does scare me that one day she'll be in an Anglo-Saxon environment and will certainly look different to everybody else, whereas here she's just one of the very many international children in the school.
Do you think that it's more prominent in the expat world to have an adopted child? Is it?
Yeah, no, very definitely, because the only stipulation we had was that we had to have lived in the country for 2 years and that we had to be under the age of 50. That was the only stipulation that we had. It's much easier to adopt overseas than it is to adopt when you're living overseas.
Do you think that's changing, Melissa? Do you think it will continue to be easier to adopt if you're living overseas, or can you see that the rules are slowly starting to change?
No, I think it will always be difficult, because the general opinion amongst Australians is that adoption is still a very negative process. And, you know, adoption never, ever comes from a good place initially. There's always a sadness attached to it, because some person has given up their baby or died and a baby's left an orphan. So it never comes initially from a good place. there's always some bereavement that's happened before. And I think people can't look beyond that a lot of the time. I know even when we've been at playgrounds in Australia playing, you know, the questions we've had from, you know, they immediately ask if we've got an open adoption, whether she'll have contact. And people come from a very Western idea about adoption in that, you know, if we'd given enough money to the birth parents that they would have kept their child, that it only takes, you know, social security payments for somebody to decide that they're not going to give up their child for adoption. People don't have a very profound idea about, especially people that come from third world countries and giving up their children. I really don't think it's going to change profoundly in Australia for a very long time.
If you hadn't adopted Asha, what would have happened to her? What would have her life looked like?
If she hadn't been adopted by somebody else, which she may have been, she probably would have gone to a home. So in Singapore, they don't call them orphanages as such. They have girls' homes and boys' homes, and she would have been there. But, you know, she's not Chinese and she's not Malay, and she's Indian. So perhaps she wouldn't have had the opportunities that she may be able to have now or will be able to have now.
Because I'm guessing, and I know this is very culturally sensitive, but I'm guessing that it is not the norm for a Singaporean family to adopt a child who isn't Singaporean.
No, and most, because I don't like to generalise, but we were told even by the Social Security Department who had our home study interview for adoption, that most Asian people will only adopt it within race. So Indians will adopt Indian babies, Malays will adopt Malay babies, and Chinese will adopt Chinese babies, mostly so that they don't have to tell the child that they're adopted.
So much. There's so much going on in my head right now. But thank you, Melissa, for being so honest, for starters.
Yeah.
I think Melissa has talked about everything that I personally have a fear with adoption.
Yeah.
And I cannot believe that a woman would come up to her and say those things to her.
And that's what
I am so scared of. I'm scared that I'm constantly, if we went ahead with this, I'm so scared that I'm constantly going to be spending my days justifying our reason why we have this adopted child.
I think there's two really interesting things on that. Is one piece of advice that Melissa gave, where she said, never ask anyone's opinion on whether you should adopt a child, because everyone has so many opinions about this, and you have to be really clear on why you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And because I asked her about that too, because I said the same thing, you know, this constant judgment.
Yes.
And there is. And people have said to her, how much did you pay for your baby? And, you know, one of the things that she said that she has done with her little girl, which I thought was gorgeous, is she's decided to lead by example, so that instead of punching people in the face, which she'd really like to do, what she'll do is they'll be walking along the street and someone will say, oh, is she adopted? Because she obviously looks different to the rest of the family. And so she'll say, Asha, would you like to talk to this man or this woman about whether you're adopted or not?
Yeah,
like, would you like to explain that? So she said she kind of lets her decide whether she wants to tell them. And mm-hmm. instead of just having the reaction she'd really love to have, which is, you fool, like, why are you doing this to my beautiful little girl?
Yes. Yeah. And I think also, I think at the moment, Asha's in a really good place where she is at a school that's really international, and there are other children there that are adopted, so she's not the only one. I grew up with a couple of friends who were adopted, and they were adopted from Asia, and they really struggled in their teen years because they were in a house with blonde-haired, blue-eyed parents, but and that's how they felt, but they looked in the mirror and they saw something different.
Mm.
And these girls are now absolutely fine, and I've seen the other side of it, but that's another fear that I have, and Melissa touched on that as well, is when they go back home, how is that going to be for Asha?
And that was what I wanted to point out on too, because, you know, we're an expat podcast, is how different is adoption for the expat kid? Because, you know, I have commented often that there is an unbelievable amount of adopted kids in my kids' classes at school.
Right.
And you're almost a little mini celebrity.
Right.
Like, it's become a really cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
And my kids will say, you know, they'll talk about it like it's the coolest thing, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, Sally's from Vietnam and her parents went and found her there and blah, blah, blah. And so I asked all of the different people, our different interviewers, if they had found that adoption was bigger in the expat world, and they said yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, really, it's no different from being in your everyday world, but what they had thought that their children had benefited from was being in an international community.
Yes.
But I guess we all think our children have benefited from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But absolutely, I think if you have a child from Thailand or Vietnam or India or whatever, and then they're surrounded by that culture, and there's 76 different nationalities. I mean, we like to say we're very multicultural in Australia, but I mean, there are pockets of schools that you look at and
you look at my sister, whose child is her biological daughter, but she's of mixed race. And the comments that she gets, the, oh, where is she from? And my sister just answers, well, she's half me, half her father. But, you know, I've seen that.
Yeah.
And it is a big fear of mine to go ahead with this.
Yeah. And I thought what I really took away from Melissa that I thought was fascinating was, having lived in Asia, I knew that that was the case, mm-hmm. that a lot of that you don't adopt out of your race because you just don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, very unusual. And that what I didn't realise was that not only was it pretty much the norm, that you also perhaps didn't tell that you were adopted, but also in Singapore, when you adopt a child, that child's birth certificate can get changed to have your name on there as the
birth parents. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you really could go through life never
keeping
knowing.
That as a
and
secret,
keeping it as a secret.
And what I thought was really cute was that Asha hasn't even asked why she's done it. That's just too cute.
Yeah.
And that just shows why we should, you know, kids are not born racist or prejudiced, are they? They don't see any of that.
No, they don't. I did ask about Asha's biological parents and whether they had entertained the idea of, you know, meeting them in years to come. And Melissa said, yep, absolutely, they have their details. They live a transient lifestyle, so they don't actually have a home of their own. But she said she was more than open to them, you know, if Asha wanted to make that happen. She just wanted to make sure that she was of an age where she was mature enough to cope with it.
And to handle it all.
That's going to be a lot to handle.
And did she... Another fear of mine is that, but I'm her mum. Do you know, to then go and meet the birth parent after, it's just all of these things go around in my head constantly, and I just don't know if I'm, you know, if I can take that step.
Okay, one of the things that Melissa wanted me to point out too, this is all 9 years ago, so things may be changing very, very quickly and differently, and it might be a completely different kettle of fish. And we are open to anyone sending us a note, letting us know, telling us we need to change.
We're not here to tell you how you go about adoption how you do it. We're not an authority on it at all.
No,
we're just telling, sharing people's stories.
That's right. So on that, I would really love for us now to listen to Katie. It's really funny because Katie, at the beginning I said, so are you a Kate? Because Katie's American. And I said, are you a Kate or a Katie? And she said, I'm a Katie. So I was like, okay, Katie. Katie was just the most beautiful storyteller, but she, what is different about her story mm-hmm. is that they were living in the US and decided to adopt. They adopted a child from Russia, and then 5 years later, her husband ended up getting a job in Russia.
Wow.
And they had to make a decision about whether they were willing to go and what wow. that involved and what would that bring up yes. with everybody yeah. and the whole visas and the yes. passports and that. It's a yeah. really complicated mm-hmm. issue, but it is the most beautiful story. So we'll have a listen to Katie, and she can tell us about why they chose to adopt.
Okay.
We were interested in having a family, and infertility was not a concern for us. I was born with Marfan syndrome, and so there's a genetic possibility that could be passed on to a biological child. And I have a very mild form of it, but it was a 50-50 chance that a biological child would have Marfan syndrome. And there's some complications that go along with carrying a child. And so my husband and I just decided, you know, what's the goal? Is the goal to be pregnant, or is the goal to be parents and have a family? And so we chose adoption. We thought the goal is to be parents. So we were living in the United States, and we did our research, international adoption versus domestic. And international really seemed to match with our ideals, I guess, of what we were looking for. And so we explored, and we chose Russia for our first child. And that took about 2.5 years. And as far as adoptions go, it was not easy. It was not the most difficult, but one of the most difficult. But through it, we received the most beautiful son. And at the time, he was 20 months old. He is now 11. And then when he was about 3, we decided we wanted another child. And we had gone back to our facilitator through email in Russia and said, look, we'd really like to adopt another child. At the time, Russian relations were not ideal. But she said, don't come to Russia. She said, go to Poland, which is what we had been considering, or do something else. But Russia is not going to be friendly right now. So we chose Poland, and we were matched with our beautiful daughter. And she was 15 months at the time, and now she's 8. And so that's our family. That's our family. Funny enough, we had been home from our first adoption from Russia for about a week. And I kid you not, my husband walked into the room and he said, hey, what if we moved to Russia? And I thought, you're smoking crack. After what we had just gone through, I thought, I'm not too sure about that. I probably went along with it just to say, sure, you know, whatever. But funny enough, when our son was 7, I mean, we had looked to move abroad. It was something that we really wanted to do. We had put in our application with the firm to move abroad. And we had some, Ukraine had come and said, well, let's just see, you know, if that's a good fit. And while that was going on, Russia came, the firm, and said, we're interested. And my husband came home one day and he said, Russia is interested in us moving there. Had a really hard cry for about 5 minutes because of what we had been through with our son's adoption. And I said, I don't know. And then after 5 minutes, put my big girl panties on, and I said, let's do it. Let's do it. I said, if this is something that you feel you need to do for your career, then let's do it. And it gives our son a chance to go and see his home country and his roots. And it seemed like a win-win. And I was scared for my son, but we did it. We did it. And it was the best 2 years, I think, of our lives so far. It really was just amazing. So that's what took us overseas.
So, Katie, can you explain, because it sounds like
the adoption process in Russia was really quite harrowing for you. Can you explain that to me and then explain why you were a little frightened about taking your son back to Russia?
You know, just to start, the international adoption process is daunting. There's a lot of documents that are required. All documents have to be notarized by someone local and then apostilled by the state, so sealed by the state. We had been in the process of adopting. Our paperwork had been with our agency for probably 18 months. We received a referral and we declined. And then we received another referral and we accepted. And we had had this precious child's information for about 3 weeks. And we were told more information would be forthcoming. Well, it never came. Our agency called us and said that we had lost the referral, that she was being used as a pawn. She was going to go to the highest bidder. So our agency backed out, and I'm glad that they did. They made the right decision. So at that point, I mean, we had been in the process for 2 years, and we had seen people come and go, receiving the referrals and coming home with their children. And our adoption agency was wonderful. They had an online community that we shared things with. And it just wasn't happening for us. So we lost the referral and we were just devastated. It's a miscarriage. So our agency called us the next day and we said, we have an idea. We want to send you to this region. And I knew the region. And it was the second toughest region in Russia at the time. So we did it. We said, whatever we got to do. So we got a phone call, I would say a month later. We traveled blind. We got on a plane. We didn't know who we were going to see, the age of the child, boy or girl. We knew nothing. And we were in country for about 3 days, and they kept saying, we don't have anything. We don't have anything for you. And I looked at my husband, and I said, in a country so big, in a region so large, there's not one child. And so a lady comes into the room, and we sat in her office all day long. She finally comes in the room and slides a piece of paper across the table and says, here, this is all I've got. So we said, okay. So the next day we went to the infant home, and we sat for 2 hours, and we listened to the medicals. And you would have thought that this child would have been severely hurt. You know, medically, physically, like what they bring in this little boy, and oh, he was so precious, and that was my son, and there's not a thing wrong with him. He's perfectly perfect. But through that, we waited 6 months to go back and get him, and we had 93 documents to do for his adoption, and we did that 3 times. Because they have to be current for court. So by the time you, and who would have thought there's 93 documents on anybody, but 93 documents you have to have, all original, all signatures, all notarized, all state apostilled, and by the time, and then they have to be translated, and then they have to get to the country, and we did that 3 times. And so, yeah, by the time, when my husband said, let's go to Russia, I thought, I don't think so, buddy. The bureaucracy was a lot, but we did it.
So, Katie, tell me, at what age did you talk to your children about their adoption?
Adoption has always been an everyday word in our house. Since the children came home and were learning English words and could speak, they've always known. And I made what's called a life book. It's like a scrapbook of their adoption and how they became who they are. And it was child friendly. So it's kind of like their own personalized book, if you will. And it talked about where they came from, how they got their name. And it talked about adoption and that they didn't grow in my tummy. So it's just always been.
And so then how was it for your son then when you said, hey, we're going back to Russia? Did he, was there anything specific that he was sort of looking for when he went back to Russia?
Oh, he cried. He cried. He was in first grade at the time, and he just boo-hoo sobbed when we said that we were moving. He didn't want to leave his friends. He didn't want to leave. He was very close to my parents. He didn't want to leave them. He sobbed. And so I had to spin it in a way that would make it okay for him. And he knew he was adopted. He knew what it meant. He's a very smart young man. So he knew what adoption meant. And I said, it'll give us a chance to go back to Russia and to see what it's like, what kind of life they live there, what kind of foods they eat, what kind of games they play. And so I had to make it child-friendly for a first grader. And he was nervous, you know, when we got there, but he did great. And in the meantime, you know, since living there, we went back to his region 3 times. We went back to his infant home 2. So he got to see where he spent his first 20 months of life. And that was quite an amazing experience. He said after the first time we went back to the home, it was as if he was a movie star. We walked in and they all remembered him. They all knew him. The ladies were, some of the same ladies were still there and I recognized them. And they were so pleased that we brought him back. And it was a beautiful day. It was snowing. It was crisp and the air was blue. It was picture it in a movie and that's in snow falling. And we got in the car afterwards and we pile into the car and it drives off. And as it's driving off, I didn't know whether or not to say anything because he was really quiet. And I said, well, what did you think? And he said, it's just nice to be remembered. And he had this smile on his face. And I thought, thank you. Because that's what you want. That's what you want. And you never know if it's going to be that way. And his story, I think, is magnificent, and not every child has that story when they go to their infant home. And I'm so pleased that my son had that. And the same thing for our daughter. We took her back to her infant home and we made it fun for them. We took gifts and diapers and, you know, some clothing, and it was a wonderful time. But for our daughter too, in Poland, we went there and they all remembered her. And she was more interested in where she slept and the mechanics of things more so than our son. And so we took our daughter, but she got to see where she slept, and the director, she remembered our daughter, and the caregivers were there, and we got to play and love on each child and hug them and pray over them. And she was really happy too. It was a blessing to do this. And that's why I say moving to Russia was just, I don't know that that was about it. I don't know that, I think the purpose for moving to Russia was really for my kids. You know, I think the added gift was living in Russia, but that's our adoption story.
How are we traveling? I'm an emotional wreck. What a wonderful story. What a beautiful story.
Yeah, it was. It was just, and just for anyone at home, Sarah and I are sitting here with tears rolling down our cheeks because the story of him going back to
I think I'm a big believer in what's meant to be will happen, and that was obviously, it was all meant to be. They'd obviously tried to adopt some other children and it didn't happen, and how they didn't give up is beyond, I mean, I just, the loopholes and everything that they have to go through to get this little child mm-hmm. is, I mean, they really fought for him.
Oh, yeah.
And it was meant to be. He was meant to be. And that she and you could hear it in her voice when they were sitting there in that room and he walked into them. She said, "That's my son."
Yes.
Like that. Yes. And that's what I want to know. I think I need to speak to these women a little bit, maybe on my own, and ask them, though, because yes. I want to know, how do you know that that's your child?
Yeah.
Do you know, is it something that just happens? Because when you give birth biologically, they are physically your children. You can't do anything about it. They're your children. So how is that when you have an adopted baby? How do you know that that's your, is it just something that happens? Is it a natural thing? Is it a mothering thing? These are all the things that go through my mind.
And adoptive parents do talk about that, don't they? They talk about that, you know, there were some, you know, referrals that they didn't take, mm-hmm. or there were times when they just didn't feel it.
Yeah.
Whereas there are other times where people talk about a husband and wife just walking in and just going,
knowing that that's our baby.
Yes. No, it was, I thought the added interest on an expat point of view with this as well too was that her boy left Russia with a Russian passport to leave mm-hmm. the country, and then obviously became very much an American little boy. But then when they went back, he had to travel in and out on his Russian passport.
Oh.
And the laws changed in that time, the adoption laws, and they banned adoption in the States from Russia. So they were effectively an American family leaving with a Russian child every time they left. And so there's that underlying fear.
Just going through all of the rigmarole of adopting a child, it's what relationship the countries have with one another at the time. At the moment in Nepal, there's an Australian family who have used a surrogate, and surrogacy in Nepal was legal. Halfway through the pregnancy, Nepal stops surrogacy.
Wow.
So then their child was born and is literally stuck in Nepal, and they can't leave with their child. So, I mean, these are all things to consider. It's not just you and your partner and what you're having to go through. It's about the relationships with the countries, which can be up and down and can change in an instant.
Okay, so our last story I wanted to talk about, because we've really talked about, I guess with Melissa, adoption was easier for her as an expat because they didn't have the same laws as they had in Australia. And although the adoption process was really difficult also for Katie, that was still easier than if she had adopted within America.
Yes.
So, but there is a flip side to this with expat life, and that's where I'd love for us to listen to Sarah, because for her, being an expat actually made her adoption process a little trickier. And so I thought we'd have a listen to her story now and see what happened with Sarah.
Well, there was three of us at that particular time, which was my husband, my 1-year-old son, and myself, who was, I was about 38, and we were living in Kuala Lumpur. I'd had an ectopic pregnancy and lost a fallopian tube in the process. I had had 2 years of back-to-back fertility treatments, which were very invasive, difficult to deal with, and just which didn't work, and then decided to go for IVF after the 2 years of fertility treatment. And it was a bit harem scarum because I was living in Jakarta and my doctor was in Singapore, and it was a bit of a cobbled together do it yourself. I used to have to drive out with my lovely driver and try and source drugs. We had people carry them over from Singapore for me. And then at the end of all that, I just made 3 eggs, two of which fertilized, and then one of which took. So bingo, look, that was a brilliant success as far as I can see, really. But the whole process was really, really stressful and invasive. So as much as I was very happy to have, you know, this healthy little boy, you know yourself when you're not finished yet. So I thought, well, we got to know a couple in KL who had adopted 3 children, and they acted as our mentors to go through the process. And I was very happy to adopt rather than to try and have another baby myself.
And so what did the process look like in KL to adopt?
It seemed very straightforward. We were involved with a Christian charity who seemed to look after mothers and unwanted babies who were attached somehow to the Indian plantation workers. So these babies tended to be sort of Indian origin, and a lot of baby girls, obviously, but I was very cool with that because I wanted a baby girl because I already had a son, and I thought, yay, a girl, yay. funnily enough, took about 9 months for us to sort of go through the process of being interviewed and sort of sussed out by the woman who worked as a, what would you say, she is the person who made things happen. There was a second strand to the process, which was that my husband had to go into an official's office in the centre of town to start the paperwork going, which was going to take, I think, about 18 months to finalise. And this is basically where we kind of fell down in the end, I guess. Well, we didn't meet the baby. We were just told by this woman that there was a suitable match for us, and I was very excited. And a couple of weeks later, she came back to us and said that a male relative of the birth mother had cottoned on to this process that was happening and was asking for a payment. Now, it's kind of accepted that you would give a donation to the birth mother to cover, you know, the hospital fees, you know, the time that she was out of work, and just to cover all expenses. But this male relative was pretty much just trying to make a fast buck out of it. And it was very sort of gently put to us by the facilitator that this sometimes happens. And she sort of left it with us without pushing the issue at all. And we talked about it. And I kind of, I don't know, is it a moral thing? I'm not sure, but I just couldn't get my head around somebody pretty much wanting me to buy the baby then, you know. And I asked that we step back from this particular case, and the baby was offered to another couple. And then another baby obviously came along a few months later, which we thought, well, this one sounds really, you know, this is going to work. You know, it was a better situation. And again, I hadn't met her. But then we were about 2 weeks before we had her to come home with us. And my husband started to get a bit quiet and a bit sort of evasive about the whole paperwork issue, until I kind of pushed him on the subject, and he said, well, he thinks that he might be being made redundant, which meant that we would be out of there by the January, and that this was sort of early December. And so he was. And so he couldn't complete the paperwork because he refused to stay in the country or look for another job in Malaysia so that we could remain there and complete the adoption process. So I had to step back from that one as well, and then we left. So it was, yeah, it was very, very sad because, yeah, you know, there was going to be a baby, and it was very sad. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, my husband could have found another position, albeit, you know, maybe, you know, 18 months, a short contract. There was plenty going on there, really. But he chose not to. But it was different for him because he's a very sort of pragmatic sort of person, hadn't really formed any attachments with something that he hadn't met yet, whereas, of course, I had. So yes, that was the big issue, really. And so, you know, I had to close up and walk away from it.
Okay.
It's really heartbreaking,
isn't it? It is heartbreaking, and I think it brings to the point how difficult adoption is within relationships.
Yes.
Like, you have to be so rock solid,
yes,
don't you?
Yeah.
And not just rock solid, but you both have to be thinking the same
Absolutely.
Thing.
And that's probably our biggest thing at the moment is I think I'm pretty much 100% ready to go forth,
yes,
with it, and Matt is not certain.
Yeah.
I think it's the difference between men and women, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you could put a baby in my arms, mm-hmm, now and I'd be like, okay, it's my baby.
Yes.
He can't wrap his head around that. He can't wrap his head around how he loves Sadie so much. He is so worried that he wouldn't have the same love,
yeah,
for another child.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of where we're,
yeah,
at.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I've said a few times this episode, I think I need to speak to some of these women.
And I think, you know, Sarah described her husband as being very pragmatic, and I should say Sarah's ex-husband too,
mm-hmm,
but being very pragmatic. And for him, you know, it wasn't a baby.
It wasn't
until
a baby.
Until it was there, you know, and she said very much the same thing for the ectopic pregnancies, because his very mathematical engineering brain was like, well, this is how things fit into boxes,
yes,
and that's all very neat and,
mm-hmm,
tidy. Whereas, yeah, I think as women, no way, we're not.
No,
like that
and as Katie all. Likened it to miscarriages in her interview, it,
I wrote
getting
that down,
so,
yes,
just, oh,
because it is, you know, and I hadn't, and I said to her at the end of that interview, I said, you used a phrase that has completely opened my eyes to what it's really like, because,
mm-hmm,
she said every time an adoption fell through, it was a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And it is,
mm-hmm,
you know, your heart gets set on something and then it's not
and
there.
And then it doesn't happen. Yeah.
And we've all done that. We've all bought the baby product for the baby we thought was going to,
yeah,
happen,
yeah,
or entertain the idea of,
mm-hmm,
that baby and what,
yep,
that baby's life. And
named the baby,
named
perhaps.
The baby.
Yeah.
Yep, all of it. And it is, you know, it says, I think for me, this episode just shows that motherhood starts, and sometimes it just starts in our heads before,
yes,
it starts anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think all judgment, you know, we always talk about women judging women.
Mm-hmm.
It's really bad in adoption, and,
yeah,
people just need to back away.
Off.
And,
yeah,
yeah, you know, and if it, I think I've really learnt, you know, because I think in Australia there was a lot of bad press about international adoptions for,
mm-hmm,
a while there, because there were a few terrible cases where the wrong people got,
yeah,
hold of babies.
And I think, as Sarah touched on it in her interview, this whole baby buying thing, I mean, that's,
yes,
just all,
yeah,
a bit
hideous.
And so now I also understand why the laws are so strict, because,
yes,
I'm sitting here as a genuine person wanting to add to our family, well, why can't it be easy for me? Well, that's because there are people in this world that are going about it the wrong way and are doing the wrong things.
Yeah.
So I understand why the laws are so,
yeah,
tough and why they're so strict.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And, you know, my hat's off to these women, these families that are really fighting to bring these babies into their homes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it is something, you know, I remember when we lived, you were asking me earlier if I'd ever considered adoption, and I said, yes, you know, Greg and I had almost a form of guilt in that when you are surrounded by starving, poverty-stricken children,
mm-hmm,
you really start to question why you're not taking those children home with you.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And yes, there's always going to be people that are using this argument of, well, that's where you should be donating your money and letting,
yeah,
them grow. And, you know, it's not always about the money. If a,
yeah,
little girl is not wanted,
yeah,
she's not wanted,
mm-hmm,
and nobody's going to use that money to educate her,
yes,
and no one's,
yeah,
going to use that money,
mm-hmm,
to look after her,
yeah,
and so when people say that, I want them to really think about what they're saying,
yeah,
is that,
yeah,
there are some children that just are unwanted.
Yeah.
And
I remember Mum coming back,
yeah,
from a holiday to China, and they were travelling around and they happened to stumble upon an orphanage,
mm,
and Mum just said it was heartbreaking, all these families from the States, from the from Australia,
mm,
waiting to take home their baby girls.
Mm.
It really opened up Mum and Dad's eyes, and they're all girls.
Yes.
There, because in that culture, it's all about the son.
Yeah.
And there's all these gorgeous little girls waiting for families.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And who are we to judge? That's my biggest takeaway. Absolutely. Just who are we to judge? Yeah.
And for me personally, it is so much more food for thought.
Yes. All right. So, Seth, shall we move on to...
Yes.
Did you find any articles that you
found? I did. I found quite a few articles. Some I took out because I felt it was a little bit...
How to,
and we don't want to go down that line. But I did find a really good one, again, from the Wall Street Journal, where I tend to sort of my first place to go to find expat articles. And it is about American expats adopting overseas and very similar stories to what we've heard today. So that's a good one for anyone to read who's interested.
Yeah.
And that was really about it as far as articles are concerned. I think if you have more questions, then you need to go ahead and do your own research. And
I think so too. Okay, your social media picks.
Yes. Now, I think I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, Matt has a new job, which now means that he's traveling all the time. Now, Matt, bless him, he's a bit of a girl when it comes to TV shows. We watch a lot of the same shows. So when he's gone, last week he was in Egypt for a whole week, and I couldn't watch our shows because, like, that is the wrong thing to do. I can't go ahead with Scandal when he's away.
No,
so then I'm sitting there bored. I mean, I could have opened a book, yes. But I was like, what can I watch? Anyway, a girlfriend of mine, Bevy, has put me onto this show. It's on the Travel Channel. Now, I believe with the Travel Channel, it's quite like the National Geographic Channel. Mm-hmm. It's on no matter whereabouts you live in the world, your cable provider has the Travel Channel.
Yeah.
And it's called International House Hunters.
Yes.
And it follows expats as they move to a new country and they're looking for a house to buy or rent. And I'm a big sticky beak when it comes to houses.
Yes.
I could sit for hours on real estate website. So this show, if you're into houses and expat, this is the show for you.
Yeah.
And it's really good because it takes you to countries like Romania, where I would have had a preconceived idea of what a house in Romania would look like.
Yes.
Well, Romanian houses, now that they've been built post communist era, are these massive American style McMansions for next to nothing. Like, I sit there and I'm like, I can't believe the amount of rent we're paying here in Doha. And like places like Paraguay, every house in Paraguay comes with a pool.
Really?
Yep. Like every house, and these people had a very tight budget, so they weren't, you know, that gin-swigging expat.
Does that pool have to have a fence, like in Australia?
No, none of them had fences.
I'm always fascinated with that.
And their stairs didn't have...
Rails.
Like, it was just open, and this was a big dilemma for this family because they had a tiny toddler with them. But the other thing about... a house in Paraguay, is they come in with like this built-in traditional barbecue.
Is that because that's how they eat?
That's how they eat.
Oh.
Yeah, it was it's a really fascinating show.
A built-in barbecue inside?
No, outside. And the way that they barbecue is different to how you and I would barbecue.
Is it a slow cook, long?
Yeah, it kind of looks like one of those open pizza oven type things, but outside. But then the way they do it is different to us. But every house came with one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very interesting.
So my social media pick this week is Lena Dunham from Girls is bringing out a new podcast.
Yes.
So Women of the Hour is what it's going to be called, and it begins in November, I think, the first week of November.
Okay.
There is a Instagram and a Twitter site that you can go to, and if you go onto iTunes now, it'll give you a little snippet of sneak preview.
Okay.
But it looks fantastic. It's basically Lena Dunham interviewing people, and I guess it's on there's a little bit of chatter about her book and what her book's all about and whatever. Actually, really, if you're looking for I often sit in the bath and watch a bit of telly.
Do you?
Yes, on my laptop. That's my thing to do. Yes.
Oh.
And my friend Adam, who lives here, you know Adam and Annabelle?
Yes. Hi, Annabelle.
He sent me a great link to the Hollywood Reporter the other day, and they do these fantastic interview series.
Yeah.
And they actually had an interview series there that went for about an hour and a bit and took two baths to get through. But it had Lena Dunham, it had Amy Schumer,
Oh, she's my new favourite person.
Oh, it had the blonde woman from Saturday Night Live, who currently plays Hillary on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yes.
Very, very funny.
Yeah, I know who you mean. And she plays Ellen DeGeneres as well in SNL.
Yes. So, yeah. And I think she plays Justin Bieber.
Yes, she does. Yeah. And Miley Cyrus. Yeah.
Anyway, it's a great look at the difference between women comics and men. It's just a roundtable discussion and well worth watching. Okay. So thank you very much, Adam. I haven't said thank you for that, but yes, I did watch it and it was excellent. And someone, one of our listeners sent us a link this morning to a brand new portable stroller that has just won all the bells and whistles and prizes.
Right.
On it folds as small as a backpack.
And no it's way.
About, I think it was all up about 5 kilos.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh. So go and have a look at it. We'll put a link in on our website. But it's called the Pocket Stroller.
Wow.
Yeah. Looks really fantastic. Really good. Yeah. So they were my two this week. You can tell I'm feeling better, can't you?
Because yeah,
I'm
back.
So he says, thank you. I know that episode for you was incredibly hard.
We had to
stop so that we could have a little cuddle.
I had to get my sobs out.
You know, which just shows it's another reason why we all need to shut the hell up about our opinions.
And, you know, I will keep everyone updated as to what we decide to do. We're nowhere near as far as these women and these families. We're still in that it does sound a little bit selfish, but life is easy at the moment with the three of us. It's really easy, and we've been through so much tragedy. I don't know if I can do it again. Unless you tell me for certain that it's going to have a happy ending, I'll go through the ups and downs. But unless I have the happy ending, I don't know if I can do it. Yeah. So,
and I imagine that's
if anyone's a psychic out there and knows if I'm going to have a happy ending, let me know.
I guess that's why a lot of people don't go there, because they just can't put themselves through it again.
Yeah.
Okay, it says, lovely, we'll be back next week. Oh, I have to say thank you. Sorry, I am going. So on iTunes, we've got some more reviews and some ratings.
Oh.
But one of them, I want to say thank you to my friend Danielle, who lives in Renmark, and she's left us a rating. And Danielle, when I was diagnosed, sent me this beautiful email saying, I've been thinking about something I can do for you, and I'm going to listen to your podcast. So she's been pruning her garden and doing her jobs around the house and ticking them off one by one. And she's left us a fantastic review on iTunes.
Okay, I'll go and check it out.
Yes,
lovely. Because yesterday I was at the supermarket and another listener came up to me and she said, I'm listening to you right now.
No!
And I was like, okay. It's just weird. It is weird.
That's so funny. Yes.
Yeah.
That is so funny.
The headphones were in her ears.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay. All right. We'll be back next week.
We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys. Bye.